anybody here vaccinated like me? Oh, anybody not vaccinated? Do we need them to leave, or are you threatened by them? Oh, good, now that's out of the way. Anybody here from a county or state health department? No? Anybody carrying a wire for surreptitious reasons? Oh. No, that's fine. That's fine. Someone asked Tom if I was going to do the same thing I did last year. Hell no. Nobody finds me more boring than I do. And after almost 20 years on the radio, I don't know why someone hasn't come in there and cut that microphone cord off, in all honesty. I want to take a totally different approach. I want you to understand the science behind this. There's very little science behind vaccines on either side. Very little of the argument. But there's a lot of science on the human immune system. And this will get a little technical. And I don't know how else to do this. Some of these pages are pretty deep that I'm going to show you here. And I just put this together today. This has been running through my mind for a long time as to how best to get this across. But if you understand how the immune system works, and there isn't any reason why you can't follow this, and if I can figure it out, you can figure it out. When you leave here tonight, you'll know what to say and who to say it to if you are bothered or cornered or need to say something to somebody, rather than, well, I just happen to believe vaccines are bad. Now, that's not going to get you anywhere. And I don't have a remote control, and I don't know which way to push the buttons. So there's three basic types of immunity, and we'll just go through these. Can you read that in the back?
Yes.
All right. The newborn inherits immunity from the mother because many protein antibodies diffuse from the mother's blood through the placenta into the fetus. When a baby's born, it's already got a functioning immune system to some degree because those proteins come across the placental barrier. It's strange that they call it a barrier because almost anything will get across it, but a lot of the mother's immune system will become a part of the baby. This becomes a problem when there's an Rh incompatibility, but I'm not going to get into that. We can talk about that some other time. The newborn does not form antibodies of its own to a significant extent. I've got another page on this, but that's really important to understand as well. You hear about antibodies, you hear about antigens. When we're through here, you're going to understand this like you understand your name. And by the end of the first month, the baby's gamma globulins, which contain the antibodies, are less than one half the original amount with a corresponding decrease in immunity. By the time the child is 1 month old, whatever antibodies it got from its mother, they're depleting fast. Okay? Now we'll define these as we go along. There's too much to write. You have to trust me on this. Thereafter, the baby's own immune system does begin to form antibodies, and the gamma globulin concentration returns to normal in 12 to 20 months. That's an important number when you're talking about antibodies in a child, a newborn baby. They're not going to be there. The child gets it from the mama, but within about a month or two, they're gone, and they don't start to develop again for about 12 months. And it's going to take 12 to 20 months for it to regain its own antibody strength. Despite the gamma globulin level decreasing after birth, the inherited antibodies from the mother protect the baby for the first 6 months against most major diseases, diphtheria, measles, polio. So when the baby's born, that's why we don't see the baby usually getting these kinds of things unless somebody's done something to foul up their immune system before they leave the hospital. What's that? Oh, do we do that? Thanks. So there's an innate immunity, and there's an acquired immunity. Acquired's the one you hear about all the time in the news. But an innate immunity is what you have when you're born, and it's with you till you die. The body's ability to immediately attack specific disease-causing organisms, a baby has this as well as an adult. phagocytosis, the macrophages, you've heard about that, going through the bloodstream, looking for not self, looking for things that don't belong there. Macrophages really don't have to be signaled that much. They just go after the enemy and they destroy it. They destroy dead and dying cells from your organs that need to be replaced. They're looking for viruses, they're looking for bacteria, they're looking for anything they can find that is not self. And then if you have a strong enough acidic condition in the stomach, that gets rid of most of foodborne and other kinds that you'll get through water and through drink. The acid mantle of the skin, what should the pH of the skin be? About 4.5 to 5.5. Your skin should be acidic on the surface. Bacteria, viruses cannot grow in an acidic environment. When I was in microbiology, we tried a few experiments after we would go around and get swabs from different surfaces and then put them in the media and stick them in the little oven to keep them warm and let the bacteria grow. When we were done, we'd put a little drop of apple cider vinegar or a little drop of apple juice or something that had acetic acid in it. In seconds, the population was dead. Presence in the blood of certain chemicals, the lysozymes, polypeptides, complement NK cells, the natural killer cells. These are the cells that are constantly looking for cancer cells. You can have blood drawn, and they'll look for an NK count. But if you have cancer, they're not going to bother doing this. This gets in the way of getting you into chemo. But if you do an NK count, NK cells can be present, but they're AWOL. Usually they're AWOL with most people who follow the standard American diet. They're present, but they don't know what to do. It's like a gelding in front of a mare in season. Doesn't know what to do. Just kind of sits there and hoping to understand the meaning of life. Oh, I forgot about that. Now, this is where it starts kind of getting a little bit heavy. You've heard the term acquired immunity. There's two basic types, cell-mediated and humoral. And I think you've heard those terms before. Every now and then when news comes out, it'll talk about the cell-mediated T cells. You've heard about T cells. They're named after the thymus gland. And then humoral immunity that comes from the B cells. To understand the effect of vaccinations on the immune system, you have to understand these two different things, T cells and B cells. Cell-mediated, this is achieved through the formation of large numbers of activated T lymphocytes. These are specifically aimed at destroying certain types of foreign agents. They're named for the thymus gland. They're processed from their earliest formation in bone marrow. Then they graduate from the bone marrow and they come up to the thymus gland and they get schooled in the thymus gland and then they go out to the lymph nodes that swell up when you get sick, full of T cells. Now there's a bunch of other cells involved in immunity, but I didn't want to get into that because this is heavy enough. T cells are there all the time. T cells are activated when you get a virus or a bacteria or something in the system that doesn't belong there. Through a cut, through the nasal, throat mucosa, anything like that, the stuff gets into the lymph glands. Your lymph nodes are the police station of the immune system, and they're packed with these T cells. They don't have to be told to do anything. They just immediately go after the enemy as soon as the word gets through the lymphatic system that it's present. Humoral immunity, now this is where vaccines start coming into the picture. This is also called a B-cell immunity because these antibodies are formed in the beta lymphocytes. They're a little different than the T lymphocytes. This is where the body develops these circulating antibodies, which are these globulin molecules in the plasma capable of attacking the invading agent. Humoral immunity involves the beta or the B-cells. So in acquired immunity, in other words, you acquire that immunity from antigens that get in the body. There's the T cells and the B cells that get involved. Now, you can explain that to your next-door neighbor or your recalcitrant daughter who wants to vaccinate her kids, can't you? Next one. So, both of these forms of immunity, T cell and B cell, require the presence of an antigen to initiate immunity. What's an antigen? Something that's not self, that doesn't belong there. Virus, bacteria, parasites, molds, these kinds of things that get into the system that don't belong there, That's what triggers the T cell first. And the B cell's sitting there watching what the T cells are doing. Humoral will follow cell-mediated. Cell-mediated happens first. So I think we can probably skip this. This is, I liked it because I liked the way I put it together, but it gets, let's go to the next one. It gets a little deep. Talk about deep. The thymus gland matures and schools the T lymphocyte for defense of the body, makes sure where a T cell leaves the thymus, it only attacks the proteins that are not self. In other words, T cells have to be taught what to go after. It's just like training an attack dog. There's some things they go after, there's some things they don't. T cells are like Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still. You know, all know that movie, right? Now, yeah, there you go. These people get together, they create this race of robots who have no morals, no religious beliefs, no political affiliations. These robots just go after the aggressor and destroy it. So he says, because of that, we've learned to live in peace, because these robots have more power over them than they had before they created them. Most of the processing occurs right after birth. Through the first few months of birth, T cells begin to develop as soon as a child is born. So besides the immunity that came across the placental barrier into the developing baby, the baby has a thymus gland. You've heard about how large a thymus gland is in a newborn baby. They used to blast these things with radiation back in the 50s because they thought that that was a bad thing. If a baby was born with a swollen thymus gland, it was sick. So they would irradiate them till they didn't have a thymus gland. Well, they had antibiotics. Why worry about it? But this is the cool thing here. If the thymus is removed before birth, and this is how they discovered this, when they would irradiate the thymus gland in newborn babies. People who had this done before birth can receive a transplanted heart or kidney with no tissue rejection, because it's the T cells that are responsible for tissue rejection. And they, like most things in medicine, it's discovered accidentally, somewhere down the road. You know, someone sitting there scratching their head. Wonder why they're not rejecting this transplant we put in them. And when they started transplants, the interesting thing they began to notice was that as soon as the kidney was hooked up to the arteries and the veins and it was functioning, or the new liver or the whatever they were getting, they were fine for 7 days and then they would die on the 8th day. You know, this is a long time ago when they started this, you know, developing it in the 40s and the 50s. And no matter what organ they put in the body, they would be fine for a week, and on the 8th day, they would die. And that's when they started to put this together. The T cells recognized this organ as not self, and it took them 8 days to mount the attack, and then they attacked it on the 8 days, killed the organ, which killed the patient. Next one. The B lymphocytes that are destined to form antibodies are processed in the liver of a fetus, and after birth, they don't fully develop until 12 to 20 months. This is the humoral part of the acquired immunity. No antibody formation during the first year of life. This is very important to understand vaccinations. A newborn, except for the antibodies it gets from its mother that are almost gone by the end of the first month of life, it cannot develop antibodies during the first year of life. The B cells that develop the antibodies inside them are still in development inside a bone marrow going on inside the newborn. Do you understand that? There's no antibody formation during the first 12 months of life. T cells react to a specific antigen by activating the whole T cell against the antigen. B cells react by producing antibodies. This makes the antigen, marks it for death. But it takes anywhere from 14 to 28 days for this to happen. So you are in a room and someone's in there with tuberculosis and they're coughing and sneezing and some aerosol goes blowing across the room and it gets inside your nasal passages, gets into the lymph, and the T cells jump on it immediately and go after it. If you have whether you're 1 year old or 100 years old, if you have a strong immune response, the T cells are just ravaging that virus, that bacterium, whatever it is, as quickly as it can. The B cells are signaled by some hormonal messengers, and they just kind of sit there watching what's going on, trying to figure out what they need to do next. And they start producing antibodies to that viral agent. And it takes anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks to produce those antibodies. This is why T-cell immunity, T-cells work first, then humoral immunity, the B-cells take time to form antibodies. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I got to slow down. Cell-mediated means we get sick. The body gets sick to get rid of the invader. The invader gets inside the cell like a virus. That which we call being sick, fever, flu, mucus, cough, vomit, diarrhea, rash, is your body's response to the invader through cell-mediated influences. It is the body that makes you sick, not the invader. You didn't get sick because you ran across the cold virus. Your body made you sick in the T-cell attack of that virus. Histamine reaction. All other kinds of processes that are taking place inside the body that you describe, that is described here as being sick. The virus didn't make you sick. The virus is just looking for a home. And it starts growing. And your body's response to that is what ends up making you sick. And that's what triggers the B cells, the humoral aspect. So certain chemicals start floating through the brain or through the blood supply, and your body starts making antibodies. So that by the end of the month, you have antibodies to that tuberculosis. And if the T cell attack was strong enough, you got sick for a week or two, and it may have just come on like the flu. Maybe your lymph glands along your neck swelled up a little bit. But within a few days, you started feeling better, and it was over with. And the most powerful part of your immune system that's going on behind the scenes that you don't feel, because you don't feel when antibodies are working, are now building up that reserve. So the next time you run across that virus, you never even know it. 2 months later, you run across tuberculosis again. You don't get sick. Nothing happens. Because the humoral part of the system has done its job. We know that because we can suppress the cell-mediated response with prednisone and inject a virus and you won't get sick. Lots of studies, a lot of your tax dollars have been spent researching that. Anybody ever had prednisone? It just sweeps the antibodies out of the bloodstream. It stops that reaction and it gives the body this anti-inflammatory effect, and it shuts down the immune system, is what prednisone does. Prednisone was one of the wonder drugs back in the 30s, and it was also known as a death drug. In other words, you didn't give it to somebody unless they were dying, because it will kill you. And I have patients who come in the clinic who just got a prescription for prednisone, and it's the 6-day. This is what you take the first day, and it's less the next day, and by 6 days, it's done. And the inflammatory process inside of the body is over with. And it's already started to wreck the endocrine system. It's started to wreck the immune system, but they're not hurting, and that's what they wanted in the first place. Get me out of pain. I don't care if it kills me. Get me out of pain. So we can inject you with prednisone, inject you with a cold virus, and you won't get sick. On the other hand, sickness can be induced by injecting the chemicals of cell mediation, the cytokines that are the messengers of the immune system. Without a virus or bacteria being present, you can be injected with cytokines and look like you've got the worst cold of your life. Now, that's the science behind this stuff, and they know this, and the vaccine manufacturers know this. Your family doctor probably doesn't. The county health department certainly doesn't. I've talked to them. Next one. So, this is kind of repeating. The B cell, which is the humoral, happens after the cell mediated has taken place and finished. Cell mediation's destroyed the invader. 10 to 14 days later, you're feeling better. The B cell's been watching. It remembers 4 to 6 weeks to produce antibodies. So if you get exposed to that again, you never even know it. That's why I think most of us in this country have probably been exposed to AIDS. You got AIDS, your body conquered it, you built antibodies for it, you didn't even know it. and a bunch of other stuff as well. So our naturally occurring sickness has both elements. Chicken pox, the virus gets in your body, you have a cell-mediated response, you get sick, you get blisters, then the humoral response begins, and you never get chicken pox again, even though exposed multiple times. You never know what happened. Generally speaking, both of these aspects occur in that order. This is what nature intended. First the T cells, then the B cells. First cell-mediated, then the humoral. First, a part of your immune system immediately goes after the invader as soon as it knows it's present. Doesn't even wait around. It produces certain chemicals that signal the second part of the immune system. If you can get that and understand that, you're going to understand the next couple of slides, and you're going to understand the heart and core of vaccinations. Are we in the unity of the faith here? Do I need to repeat anything? Of course, you'd be embarrassed to put your hand up at this point. We have never seen the second before the first until the 1940s. This is what happens with vaccines. The whole point of vaccines is to stimulate a humoral response without the cell mediated first. This has to be understood to understand vaccines. They skip the natural process of cell mediation that would be followed by humoral mediation. This is the quintessential cart before the horse. You got that? They just leave the cell-mediated behind and go straight for the humoral. They have to do something to stimulate the formation of antibodies that is contrary to the way nature designed us. We should get sick first. Sick isn't bad. There's ways to control the sickness. The sickness is your body making you sick, not the bug. It's trying to deal with the bug. In the background, the humoral system is sitting there, let me at them, let me at them. But by the time they're ready to get at them, the cell mediated has already destroyed them. And so the humoral says, well, just wait till they show up again for the rest of your life. With vaccines, they skip the cell mediated and go straight to the antibody formation. Next one. If vaccines stimulated the cell-mediated response first, kids would get sick. So what parent's going to take their kids to a doctor that makes their kids sick? Kind of elementary. That would be a smarter way to do it if you really wanted to get... You know, they used to do this. Some of you in here look like you're old enough for the old chickenpox parties. Those new people down the street, honey. Kids got blisters all over them. You better get Buster down there. Because Buster hasn't had the chicken pox. So he goes down there and they play in the dirt and they play in the mud and they don't wash their hands before they eat. And he picks up the chicken pox virus. But because his mother was really concerned with the health of his gut and fed him whole foods and nothing from the dead department of the grocery store, which is the center section. It's in a box, a bag, or a can. It's in the dead department. And he's got a robust immune cell-mediated response. But he gets sick. And she says, look what you've done. You got him sick. But the husband, having heard this lecture, understood. Nature was taking its course. Yeah, he just put boxing gloves on him so he doesn't scratch those blisters open and scar himself. And he'll be fine. 2 or 3 days later, 5 days later, the sore throat's gone, the rash is gone, the blisters are receding, and he's back out there playing in the mud and the dirt, and now he has lifetime protection against chickenpox. Thing about the vaccine is that the viral agent in the vaccine is dead or nearly dead. They use the word attenuated, which means it's nearly dead. So how does the body react with immunity to a dead virus? It doesn't. It just, you know, no worry. That's nothing to worry about. No, that's nothing. There's something I'm going to worry about. I'll attack that one. But dead stuff blowing through? No, I don't worry about that. So you have to force the body to react to the dead agent. This is where you put in mercury or aluminum or formaldehyde to shock the system in reacting to the dead virus. This cannot happen any other way. That's why that stuff is in there. Jolt the system. So it starts a humoral antibody response to the presence of that virus or bacterium. Primarily virus. Okay. The use of these chemicals is defended by calling them preservatives. They are, in fact, called adjuvants. And an adjuvant is something that is necessary to make the body recognize something it would not otherwise recognize and then make a reaction to it. You've heard of the term of adjuvants, also called excipients, but generally called preservatives, to give you the false idea of what they're really in there for. This is not the way body was designed to operate, so you have to do something irritating it to force it to recognize the dead viral agent. There's no way around this, because it won't recognize it, because it doesn't have the structure on the outer wall of that virus or that bacterium that signals your immune system, this is not self, attack it and destroy it, because its life force is gone. It's just trash floating through the system that your liver and kidney and spleen and other and your the macrophages and everything else will clean up in time. Next one. It's funny that people ask for safer vaccines to make them with less mercury. Sure, we'll make them with less mercury. We'll just put in more aluminum. Now, that's the truth. Or more formaldehyde, which is a known carcinogen. So since the 40s, if you do this to enough people, enough kids over and over, you'll get a suppressed cell-mediated response, meaning if you give them enough of these shots, the T cells just are stunned. They just don't work. Kids get sick. And a heightened humoral response. In other words, the second part of the immune system is reacting at higher levels than it should be. It's going nuts. The whole order gets upside down. Why? Because that was the intention, to make your immune system get nuts. So antibodies would form so they could draw blood 2 or 3 weeks in their studies after somebody was given a vaccine. Oh, the vaccine works. There's antibodies for it right here in their blood. Look, it's right here. Look. But they forced it outside the laws of nature to occur. Vaccines are designed to bypass cell mediation. Vaccines are not designed to trigger normal response in the body. But isn't that the idea you're given? Doesn't the media try to portray an image that vaccines are just helping your body to do the job it needs to do, when in fact it's turning it upside down and inside out? So you make a list of diseases that you're seeing all the time now without a cell-mediated response. Asthma, allergies, eczema, Crohn's, colitis, MS, Parkinson's, Sjogren's, Hashimoto's, and I could fill the next 3 pages with diseases where you don't get sick. You just have symptoms starting to show up. You don't go through the coughing. You don't go through the diarrhea. You don't go through the rash. You don't go through the vomiting. You don't go through the fevers. You don't go through the sore throats and the nasal congestion. You just suddenly, something isn't right. They do a blood test. They see the autoantibodies present. Oh, you got Hashimoto's. But what's that? Well, your body's attacking your thyroid. But don't worry, we have drugs for that. We can help you with that. Oh, you got Sjogren's. Oh my goodness, your nervous system's going nuts in your extremities here, or you've got Crohn's. No wonder you're going to the bathroom 15 times a day. You have Crohn's. Well, where'd that come from? Oh, you know, the body has time bombs in it. The body has landmines, and the best we can do in life is to try to skirt the edge and take our vaccines and our Tylenol and do the best we can and avoid those landmines going off inside of us. And unfortunately, the landmine of Crohn's has gone off inside you. And then you take the blood and you examine the blood, and there's autoantibodies for the intestinal lining, for the intestinal mucosa. The immune system is attacking its own gut that keeps the immune system alive. We never had that stuff before until about the last 50, 60 years. Did vaccines cause this? We don't know. Why don't we know? Well, you're going to find out. Are vaccinated children healthier than unvaccinated? We don't know, because there's no research. Are unvaccinated healthier than vaccinated? We don't know. No long-term studies, none. You ever done something in your life and you were happy that you did it, but then you got to thinking after you did it, you should have been a lot better at it? My first marriage would fall into that one. Dr. Paul Offit is the director of childhood diseases at Baltimore Children's Hospital in Maryland. And I am a weekly guest on the Doug Steffen Show. Before I do my own daily radio show, I'm on Tuesday mornings now. I'm on his show, 8 o'clock East Coast time. He has these four medical experts on his show during the week, and he always introduces me that way. And off air, I say, Doug, damn it, I told you, stop calling me a medical expert. I don't like that. So one morning, I'm hooking up my broadcast equipment in my house to be on his show. And I have the headphones on and the microphones all ready to go. And he says, I didn't have a chance to tell Dr. Stockwell in advance, but I brought him on here for a debate with Dr. Paul Offit on vaccinations. Shit. Now, I knew a little bit about Dr. Paul Offit. I'll tell you about here in a second. But this was my argument. He went first. You always want the fool to go first, because they expose their argument and the holes in their armor right off the bat. So he went first, and I said, then it was my turn, and I said, Dr. Offit, that's all well and good, but we have no studies to prove what you just said. Well, that's not true. Cite me one, just one long-term study. I'll take a 2-year study. I really want a 50-year study. Give me a long-term study anywhere that shows vaccinated is better or unvaccinated is better, because there are none on purpose. Well, I've got one. Would you forward that to me? I'd like to see it, because maybe you can bring me into the light and I can stop misleading all these people on my radio show. What I should have said before I said anything was, Dr. Offit, I think the audience should know you own 13 vaccine patents before this debate starts. But out of respect, which I quickly lost before the end of the debate, I didn't do it. But usually people like this that promote that stuff have some material gain. 13 vaccine patents. And he forwarded to me the long-term study. Was 2 weeks on 13 kids in his hospital that were given a vaccine that showed a humoral response in less than 14 days. So, remember that. Because as I said at the beginning, there's no science in vaccines on either side of the argument. There's a lot of anecdotal stories. Yeah, I can't tell you the number of mothers who have come in for consultation with their autistic child who was fine before they got the MMR. Let's go on. I was in elementary school in the 50s and 60s. I know I don't look like it, but I turned 64 last week. And no one got sick. Those of you who are a lot older than me, 65 or older. Do you remember anybody sick when you were kids? Because I don't. There was, you know, these snot-nosed, constantly, chronically ill kids running around all over the place. We never had any sick kids. You know, we played in the dirt, the ponds, the mud. We didn't wash our hands before eating. And now anywhere, 20 to 40% are some of the numbers I've seen, especially from WebMD, will tell you that. And just look at their side ads. of some kind of chronic sickness characterized by excessive antibody production. Now, you go back to the beginning of this. What produces antibodies? B cells. Why does a B cell produce an antibody? Because it watched the T cell turn a virus, tore it to pieces, and it built an antibody to it. Antibodies just attach themselves to the bad guy when it shows up again and mark for immediate elimination. It's destroyed before you ever have a chance to get sick. But what's happening, where's excessive? That's the key word here. Where's excessive antibodies coming from? Why are these chronically sick kids full of antibodies? Because it was the point of the vaccination program, the goal to make antibodies without the kid getting sick first. Because again, if you took your child to a pediatrician to enhance the immune response and they got sick from what the pediatrician did, because a pediatrician opened up his, you know, vaccination book or his immune book from medical school and actually followed the way it was supposed to be done, you wouldn't take any kids back there. I know I'm repeating myself, but I'm going to make that point. Vaccines are designed to skip over the sick part and go straight to antibodies. So is there any proof of what I'm saying? Well, there's a study. It was just, you know, wasn't that long ago in Kobe, Japan, where they took these mice and they constantly gave them repeated vaccinations. And these mice started blooming with autoimmune diseases. An autoimmune disease is where your immune system starts attacking you. Dr. Paul Ehrlich, over 100 years ago, the one who developed Salvarsan, which was the antibiotic for syphilis, and he invented that in France, arsenic-based, which, of course, killed most of the people they gave it to. But if you could survive the arsenic would kill the syphilis. And then you can go on about your life. In their studies, they began to notice in their research that some of the people that they gave Salvarsan to started developing excessive antibody populations. And they began to attack the tissues of the body. Josh, do you remember the name of that disease? Something like that. They gave it a name, and it had horror in the name. And Ehrlich said, this is absolutely impossible. The body would never, ever attack itself. You ever heard of Dr. Royal Lee? Yeah. Oh, good. 1951 and earlier, he's presenting presentations on their research of autoimmunity, the body attacking itself. The FDA got so upset, they came to his place there in Wisconsin, went into his laboratories, took his notes, his books, and everything else, and took it out in the parking lot and piled it up and said, we're going to put you in prison or we're going to burn your books and your notes. Fahrenheit 451, right there in the parking lot of a building in Wisconsin. It's right there in the bottom right, just north of Chicago. Milwaukee, right there in Milwaukee. He wanted to go to jail. Said, put me in jail. I'm not gonna burn this. Well, his friends prevailed on him. If he was in jail, he couldn't do his work. So they burned everything. To this day, standard process is not allowed by the FDA to publish his research. So there's an outfit, Weston A. Price Organization in California, that prints his, publishes his stuff. And if you're not familiar with WestonAPrice.org, you should be. WestonAPrice.org, just like it sounds. Some say, well, that hasn't happened in humans. Sure, you could do it in mice. What's happened the last 70 years of vaccination use in this country? They did it in mice in just a matter of weeks. We've been doing it to human beings for over 70 years. There's a whole new branch of medical research, diseases of autoimmunity, which is the biggest subset now of autoimmune diseases. And the last time I counted, it was about 62 or 63 autoimmune diseases that did not exist before 1940, before World War II. Now it's one of the largest areas of medical specialty. So do they work? Well, they're you know, so we're coming down to the end here as far as this is concerned. Three basic issues. Do they work? Well, most of the diseases were almost eradicated before the vaccine showed up. So it's a huge question as to whether they actually work or not. You're familiar with that. I think most of you who looked into this, you know that most of the diseases, by the time the vaccine showed up, were already gone. Polio, for instance, was more than 90% eradicated once they found out what caused it, and everybody started cleaning up the water supply. And then the second one, what about all those excipients, the adjuvants? They're all neurotoxins. They all destroy nerve cells. The shock that these things bring to the immune system to trigger a humoral response, antibody formation, they're nerve poisons. And formaldehyde is known in small amounts to cause cancer. And then the third one, is anyone concerned with reversing the natural order of cell mediation to be followed by humoral mediation? Is this where we're getting an autoimmune explosion? We don't know. There's no research. I suspect. So this is where a piece of the Patriot Act comes in. Can you guess what the Patriot Act has to do with vaccination? Yeah. October. Well, if you're patriotic, you'll get a vaccination. And if you get a side effect, you won't sue the pharmaceutical company. That's true patriotism there. My country first, right or wrong. Next one. So it comes down to this. What's the potential benefit of injecting a child or an adult with a known neurotoxin with an immune-shifting chemical, getting the humoral in front of the cell mediated? And there's not an issue as if it will happen. It's happening everywhere. It does not always rise to the level of a life-destroying disease, but you can't repeatedly vaccinate somebody and not expect their immune system to react accordingly. Next one.
Can you entertain questions as you're on certain subjects, Dr. Stockton?
Yeah, we might as well, because it's...
So, you know, we hear when you step on a nail, go down and get a tetanus shot, or, you know, you get lockjaw, and we fear the repercussion if we don't do that. So, I mean, are they beneficial in certain cases, like,
where does botulina or Clostridium tetani grow? Manure. If there was manure around the nail, maybe. There's other things you can pour into that wound, like lobelia and some other things that people do and seem to be just fine. I'm not telling you not to do that. I'm not telling anybody not to get a vaccination. But, you know, you get a sliver in your finger and they want to give you a tetanus shot because they make money off of that. But Clostridium tetani only grows in manure, which was why it was a very familiar thing in the farm setting. You step on a nail and there's been cattle or horses or something nearby, then there's a chance that you could get it. It's very rare. It's almost difficult to get that thing. So I don't know if that answers the question. You use the tetanus shot as an example. If you're leaving this country and going over to help those poor Ebola victims, there's some shots you're going to have to get, or customs will not let you back in the country, like yellow fever. You have to get a yellow fever shot before you leave. You don't have to get it if you don't want it, but you're not coming back in the States unless you have Ebola. Yeah. That's good. That was good, Tom.
So just to follow up, so like smallpox, we all got smallpox vaccinations years ago. They don't do that anymore because they say they eradicated it through the vaccination process.
Yeah. So the history of smallpox and vaccines is a very interesting history. It goes back to the 1700s. Joseph Lister, and he injects the little boy, eventually goes insane. They don't talk about that in the story. But everywhere they initiated the smallpox vaccine, smallpox just exploded like crazy. Germany did it for a while. England did it for a while. Almost every book on the history of vaccines will talk about that. Where does smallpox come from? From a bed bug. Yeah, you get bit by a bed bug that's carrying the smallpox. Where did smallpox proliferate? Interestingly enough, it wasn't among the wealthy. There's a story behind every one of those. So the parent, I've had these conversations. I've had people tell me this. Yes, I know it will shift them towards allergies. It'll give them an autoimmune disease. It may give them cancer. But I'm not willing to live with them getting chickenpox. Fine. So what I don't like is the health department or hospitals, pediatricians saying vaccines work great and there's no downside. So, I'm probably asked more questions about this in the clinical setting than anything else. And I just try to tell them, listen, the internet is full of really good information. Why don't you check out both sides of the story? That's what I've said up until about a month ago. Because when Tom said, no, I'm not kidding. I really want you there that first weekend in November. Come in and talk. And I didn't know what I wanted to say. But I put this thing together for what I'm trying to tell patients now. And I don't have time to go through this whole thing. But are you getting the picture here what vaccines do? They turn the immune system upside down. Intentionally. To bypass the sixth stage and go straight to the antibody stage. Is there an accumulative effect? Is there a price to pay fooling around with the human immune system? Where in the world are all these autoimmune diseases coming from? Do we have research that shows that the majority of those suffering from autoimmunity got vaccines first? No. There is no research. Nobody will fund it. And nobody's going to do research unless they're paid to do research. I sit on an upper cervical research board. We deal with that in our monthly meeting every month. We need money to do this research. People won't work for free, even if it's for a good reason. Let's see what the next one is. And have you heard of the herd? There's another argument you're going to get. And people with a straight face, they're going to give you this herd immunity. And you want to, you think you're missing something when they give you the herd argument. Say that again. Your kid's vaccinated. My kid isn't. And some of these other kids over here aren't. But if we get them all vaccinated, then your vaccinated kid won't get sick. But isn't that why you vaccinated him? The school nurses push this. Health departments push this. And I still, to this very moment, I think I'm missing something here. I did my undergrad down at the Y, and I had a class in logic. It wasn't easy, because I was still a teenage boy, and my logical patterns followed a certain direction, and not by the book. But I understood that A equals B equals C, then A equals C. I understood that. But, now if you vaccinate enough people, is anybody here not, those of you who haven't been vaccinated, anybody not been vaccinated for polio? You got vaccines, but you didn't get a polio vaccine.
No vaccine.
That's what I'm saying. Don't put your hand up if you haven't had a vaccine. How many of you have not been vaccinated for polio? How'd you escape? Well, that's a good answer. Because they don't know either. That's good, because nobody keeps records of this stuff. So a lot of you have simian virus floating around in your bloodstreams right now. I stood in line in my junior high school to get the sugar cube. I had two of them on the arm. The doctor said to my parents, the first one didn't take. Not because I got smallpox. I didn't get smallpox. They just told my parents, we don't think that one took. We're going to do it again. Yeah. Only bigger this time. So I got a scar here. I got my smallpox scar. And then never got smallpox, thank goodness. And then I guess it worked. Nobody I knew got smallpox. The herd immunity must have worked there. Then I got the sugar cube for polio with my parents and two younger brothers lined up in front of the junior high, you know, waiting to get our chance to get a sugar cube. Did you get sugar cubes? The only polio vaccine, the only vaccine now, or the only polio is coming from the vaccine for the last 20 years. When I was in school in virology and communicable disease class, there was a farmer in Iowa who got polio from his baby. Polio has to go through the body twice. It follows what's called the oral fecal route. Fecal meaning fecal. You get polio, your body deals with it, you don't even know you have it. Nobody gets sick from polio the first time. Then it gets into the feces and gets out of the body, and some people have a hard time washing hands. And so this farmer, working the farm, his wife worked in town, so he took care of the baby, and he wasn't careful about changing the baby's diapers. And he got the paralytic polio because it had gone through the baby's digestive system once. Wasn't careful about eating that ham and cheese sandwich after he changed the diaper. And got polio. This is a true story. This is how people get polio today because of the vaccine. So, what difference does it make if my child's not immunized and yours is? Can he get sick from my child? So if there are no consequences from the neurotoxins and the vaccination, what difference does it make if my child isn't vaccinated? Next one. All right, now I want to tell you something about chiropractic in relation to the Spanish flu and probably Ebola. 1918 killed 100 million people in 6 months, more than all the wars put together. Chiropractic was just a baby then. How many of you have a chiropractor? Oh, that's good. That's why you look healthy. Because there's something about chiropractic you may not know. Patients who saw a chiropractor had a better than 40-to-1 chance of surviving the flu than those who saw a medical doctor. This is how chiropractors got licensed in the 20s. Those who went to a chiropractor who had contracted the flu, 40 of them would get old, or one of them would get old, or one of them would die, where 40 of them that went to a medical doctor would die. Did I say that right? Your chances of dying are 40 times greater back then going to the medical route than to go see a chiropractor. Next one. Today we see chiropractors for what? Neck and back pain. You know, I see some of that, but I see a bunch of other stuff. In 1918, they saw chiropractors for infectious diseases and general sickness, not pain. This is before the antibiotic vaccine era. People went to a chiropractor because they were sick. Go ahead. The first 50 years of history was pushed aside when the antibiotics appeared. People who had the flu went to chiropractors, found out something that happened. They survived at 1/45 the death rate of those who saw an allopathic doctor. I guess I'm repeating myself. Go ahead. Spine magazine, January 1997. When a supportive ligament is activated by an outside force, the afferent nerve synapses with an adjacent afferent sympathetic nerve, further activating the sympathetic nervous system. What controls the immune system inside the human body? It's all sympathetic. It is all under the control of the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight aspect of your existence. The parasympathetic is the one that just, isn't it time for a nap? Is that what you want in charge when you get exposed to a virus or a bacteria? No. The sympathetic. So what they found out was that a single spinal ligament that is activated, as chiropractors do, as it gets inside the cord, in one of the ascending tracts inside the spinal cord, they're always immediately associated with an afferent sympathetic nerve. In other words, whenever you receive a chiropractic adjustment, the sympathetic system turns on. We did a little study on this when I was in school at Palmer. We drew blood on a patient, and we looked at a certain part of the lymphocytic aspect, and we gave, and that person received a chiropractic adjustment. 20 minutes later, another blood sample was taken, and the beta lymphocyte population went up 30% within 20 minutes of that chiropractic adjustment. It's called cerebellar plasticity, which is a response to sympathetic innervation. But two nerves side by side, who would think of that? Who would think of when they were building the human body would put two things together like that? Next one. I was going to get into this. I think this is really important. This is, but I've gone over time, haven't I?
No.
Well, the people's vox populi. I need to, yeah. I haven't heard that story, but I understand the process. So you feel better while you're dying. Yep. All right. Now I need to get to here. Oh no! I'm in the wrong place. Oh, my wife put this on here, and I got to remember where she put it. I hope my porn isn't on here. Oh, here we go. I've mentioned this on the radio show a couple of times. Lawrence Livermore Laboratories back in... Have you ever heard of Lawrence Livermore? They were tasked by the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense to weaponize bubonic plague back in, 10, 15 years ago. They published... they actually came out and published what they did in 2002. That's what this is. And they used plague, but there's something about... There's two things here I want you to understand, because when you go out of here and you got this idea that vaccines flip the immune system upside down, well, what are you going to do now? Well, I got an answer for you. Plague is potentially a deadly agent of bioterrorism, and this whole thing talks about bioterrorism, weaponizing these bugs. Today, Yersinia pestis is one of the several infectious diseases and agents, the highlighted yellow. Department of Energy complex are studying as part of the Chemical Biological National Security Program. Do you know you had one of those? A few strains in the middle there are believed to have been genetically modified. Oh, I can do that from up there. No, I'm all right. I'm only 64. A few strains have been genetically modified to be more deadly. Plague research at Livermore currently is focusing on what makes Y. pestis so virulent. Using plague as a prototype for functional genomics of a larger set of pathogenic agents that can be used for biological terrorism. Now, your government was funding this. Nixon signed an executive order in 68-69. You will not weaponize a viral or bacterial agent. But they did it anyway. But I mean, who pays attention to presidential directives? The highly contagious Y. pestis is an excellent model for studying pathogens. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. Earlier research has shown that when Y. pestis is grown at the body temperature of a flea, which is about 10 degrees centigrade colder than a human, its cells divide, but it does not express or turn on the genes that make it virulent in a human. So fleas are what give you bubonic plague. Every year you hear about bubonic showing up in Colorado and New Mexico, don't you? And it's there for a week or two, and they contain it, and it's all over with, and they don't worry about it. Now, this temperature thing is what's important, and Jeff, you played right into that. Next one. Slide down the page. Yeah, I know. Well, I understand. When the temperature increases to 37 degrees centigrade, the bacterium begins to produce the proteins essential to its virulence, which is human temperature. So they got these fleas. They're keeping them at 27 degrees centigrade. So they're alive and they're bouncing around. That's their normal temperature. And the Y. pestis, the bug that lives inside the flea that causes bubonic plague, is not activated to where it will hurt a human at the flea temperature. The flea then bites the human. Y. pestis gets inside the human. Let's go to the next one. It's a great study. But I'm just giving you the best parts. For the 96-spot microarray, the team developed a protocol to study the response of Y. pestis genes under conditions that mimic the infection process at both flea and human body temperatures, and at calcium levels that correspond to those of blood, higher level, and organs, lower level, the latter, the organs, location being where more virulent genes are expressed. Now, stay with me. More recently, they developed a microarray for all 4,500 Y. pestis genes. All of the genes are being mapped at 6 time intervals as temperature rises and calcium concentrations drop. So when they were doing the studies, they would raise the temperature of the animal and make sure the tissue calcium levels were dropping. By comparing samples grown at the two physiological conditions, mimicking the flea and the human at the low calcium concentration to induce virulence. You follow me on that? Do I need to explain that?
Yes.
I've come prepared. There's only one minute. I think that's it. Oh, there's a conclusion, but that's not necessary. There's only one mineral in the human body that has a gland to regulate it. Calcium. There's no gland to regulate copper or iron or manganese or magnesium. Nothing to regulate all the other trace minerals the body requires. But there is an organ to regulate the levels of calcium in the system, and it's called the parathyroid. You got 4 lobes on each side of the thyroid, which is why they call it the parathyroid. Normal, paranormal, thyroid, parathyroid. Well, some people don't know that. I didn't know it till. Calcium is necessary for the skin. Calcium is necessary for the heart. Calcium is necessary for immune function. It's necessary for nerve transmission signals. And the list, I could mention several more here. There are tons of studies out there. Literally, if you go to PubMed and you Google on PubMed, calcium and infectious diseases, you'll find a lifetime of reading. People who go into the hospital with low calcium levels have a greater chance of dying. The first thing they should do for anybody being admitted to the hospital, check the serum calcium and the tissue calcium because of this study. Because what they found out in their test animals, when the animals would get sick, the genes would turn on in Y. pestis, and it would attack the parts of the body that had low calcium levels. And that's what kills with bubonic plague. Yes, ma'am.
So are you saying if you are going to be admitted to a hospital, you should maybe
boost your... Absolutely. Should you boost your calcium levels if you're going to go be admitted to the hospital? Absolutely. When this study was done, back in, 1987, 1988, published in 2002, the conditions in the hospital then weren't as bad as they are now. I had a kidney, bladder, prostate problem a year ago this week. And I, telling the PA how to do their job, and they respected me for that. I said, this is how I want you to do this and this and this to maintain some sterile integrity. Would you please? I still got a horrible infection. So that the bottom line there. Disease processes bring fever because it's triggered by what? T cells. Very good. Thank you. The cell-mediated aspect will bring on fever because fever at 101 to 102 will kill viral elements. 103 to 105, it kills bacteria. That's one of the ways the emergency room knows what kind of an infection you probably have, by how high the temperature is on admission. Well, he's got a temperature of 104. Well, he's got a bacteria. Well, he's puking and pooping and can't move, and he's got a temperature of 101, 101 and a half. Oh, he's probably got a virus. It's that predictable. Ebola, we worry about it at what temperature? 100.4, isn't it? 100.3, you can, like Tom said, just go out there and sing and dance and have fun with your friends. 104, you know, we got to watch you. So how do you get calcium in the body? Let's go back to keynote. Oh, you'll love this one. The Kellogg School of Ophthalmology at the University of Minnesota developed a camera that can take pictures at 600,000 frames per second. And they put it on a little tiny instrument, and they put it in the bloodstream so they could see what goes on inside the bloodstream. And what they found, it's not all that, they found that what happens, this is a phagocyte, probably a macrophage, and there's the bad guy, and it's coming around it to do something with it, probably eat it. And they discovered something called the calcium wave, and it was only because of the 600,000 frames per second that they could slow down that they saw what happened. And what they saw was that when it would surround it, this wave of the serum in the bloodstream, this wave would form around the bug, and it looked like it was electrocuted, and it stopped moving. And cell permeability, the cell wall permeability increased, so that this thing could inject its oxidative chemicals inside of it and just destroy it like popping a balloon, which is what this picture is after it got a hold of this. And then a few seconds later, this was in the same spot in the bloodstream. And it was called the calcium wave. They didn't know what else to call it because they took a sample of the serum, analyzed the mineral content, loaded with calcium. That should have been on the front page of every newspaper in America. Next one. So this is what I tell my patients. Those of you who are familiar with standard process, you know about this. I can't count the number of patients who no longer get colds or flus in the wintertime. The kids don't get coughs and choke. They don't get whooping cough. They don't get anything else. Calcium, you have to get calcium in the form that nature intended, and that's the form that's in vegetables or something that ate the plant. It's the calcium that's in the plant kingdom or something that ate the plant kingdom. Calcium lactate. It's not milk calcium. It's ionizable calcium and lactic acid, the good lactic acid, not the kind of lactic acid you get when you get a stitch because you've been running too hard. Cataplex F is just simply vitamin F. The FDA says that doesn't exist. They said it did up till after World War II, and then they said, nah, you don't need that. There's enough vitamins. We don't need to put another one in there. Vitamin F takes calcium out of the bloodstream and drives it into the tissues. Cataplex C is the bullets of the immune system. Every day. I do. Well, it's not sold in health food stores. It's only sold in doctor's offices. And there's a reason why. Because the stuff works. And because it works, the FDA is constantly watching things that work in the alternative market. Things that work, they shut them down as fast as possible. Which is why 99% of what's in a health food store isn't going to do you any good. Any health food store people here? Because most of it's synthetic. Most of just chemicals. Fractioned chemicals manufactured in a laboratory. They bring the chemicals in from China. It comes in through Baton Rouge or Louisiana or New Orleans through Hoffman LaRoche. Then Hoffman LaRoche has all these super mega powered atomic drive thermodynamic vitamin B super mega formula coming through. And then another one comes through, they just change the label. Another one comes through, they just change the label. Another one comes through. And they're all fractions that usually lead to vitamin deficiencies. But this is when I talk about 636. So for those of you who are interested, my wife insisted I do this. I've got some coupons here. The office will recognize a massive discount on this stuff. I can't, when people are asking me, what are you going to do about Ebola? 636, 6 calcium lactate, 3 cataplex F, 6 cataplex C. And I have to do that the rest of my life? Well, if you'll eat deep ocean fatty fish 3 times a week, and you'll eat your weight in strawberries, and you'll drink at least 6 glasses of raw whole cow's milk a week, no, you don't have to do that. Kefir has good calcium in it. No, there's nothing wrong with kefir. But anybody here into raw cow's milk?
No, where?
Where? There's a place in Orem, right there on 800 North. Do you know where? Right there in the corner of 800 and State, where that Sonic drive-in is? It's just right behind the Sonic drive-in. It's called Real Foods. There's one in Heber. There's one in St. George. And then there's one in Sugar House. 2002 South Highland Drive. So my wife and my son, who's never had a single shot, he just turned 15 on the same day I turned 64. He's now about an inch and a half taller than I am, and has never had a single shot. And he was in a car with his friend the other day. They're going to basketball practice. And his friend was saying to the mother that was driving him there, Rourke's never had a vaccination. And the mother turned to my son and said, you must be sick all the time. And I said, Rourke, you're exaggerating. No, Dad, that's exactly what she said. In 15 years, I remember 3 days he got sick. And that's when he went from the 8th grade to the 9th grade. And he got a fever. I think he threw up a half a dozen times. And then it was over with. Cell mediated. I don't know what he had. I'm not a virologist. And it was over with. Is there another one? I'm worried. No, that's it. That's it. So, I've got the article in here. There is one more thing here. Where is he? Right there. Yeah, you might want to see that. Tom was alluding to this. And Dr. Wakefield, that was smeared by some lying agents inside the CDC. Why don't you pull that down a little bit if you can? Doesn't like your fingers. Can you read that? I'm not going to do the whole thing. In response to the 2014 Centers for Disease Control and Prevention declaration defending the validity of the 2004 DeStefano study, biochemist Brian Hooker responded and outlines inconsistencies in the agency's research practices and position. The irrefutable fact that valid information about the race, referring to African-American boys, for the entire study sample, 2,448 children was available, accessible to school records. Well, let's jump down, because you can get the link from this and look at most of it later. Decisions were made here it is. In addition, Dr. William Thompson, a CDC scientist since 98, also released a statement August 27, 2014, to support Dr. Hooker's assertion that the CDC withheld important data that significantly altered the study's outcome. Decisions were made regarding which findings and report after the data was collected. The study co-authors observed results indicating a statistical association between MMR timing and autism among African-American boys, that they introduced the Georgia birth certificate. And in other words, they were trying to make sure they had the right population. Go on down here. Hooker and Thompson both concluded the study's original data revealed a strong statistical association between the timing of the MMR vaccine and autism incidents in African American boys. 10 years ago, Dr. Thompson expressed concerns about the MMR study's findings in an urgent letter to then director of the CDC, Gerberding, and now it's Frieden. Hooker wrote, I will have to present several problematic results relating to statistical associations between the receipt of the MMR vaccine and autism. Well, he was immediately dropped from the conference schedule. He wasn't allowed to speak. He received no supply but was removed from the speaker schedule just days before the meeting. The report continues to be widely cited for its position of exonerating vaccines' role in causing autism. Gerberding subsequently left the CDC and became president of Merck. Yeah. Oh. You know, in the FDA, there's either 31 or 32 people who are members of the review board. After you've spent your millions, some of which I'm sure must be under the table, after you spent your millions, or in some cases hundreds of millions, and you've gone through your trials, and you've gone to West Africa and told those poor people, listen, we'll feed your family for a year if you let us inject these chemicals in you, which has been going on for a long time. And there's an interesting relationship between that and Ebola. Then they take all the those statistics and they bring them back together. But what this thing is referring to here is African-American boys here in America where this stuff was done. I regret my co-authors and I omitted statistically significant information in our 2004 article. The 2004 article published in Journal of Pediatrics was the one that said there is absolutely no connection between MMR and vaccines. About as stupid as that woman in that article that you read from. You know what? You got me thinking about something. You said, if you can't trust the federal government, and you had a whole litany there of crimes against the people, what else can you not trust in that magazine? Go Utes. An office of the Inspector General investigation concluded the CDC was allowing many scientists, medical experts with significant conflicts of interest to participate. The bottom line here is, in addition, former CDC vaccine autism researcher Paul Thorson, who can't be found right now, incidentally, who co-authored several studies widely cited as proof there's no link between vaccines and autism, has been indicted and charged with 13 counts of wire fraud, 9 counts of money laundering awarded to the CDC for autism-related research. Given this abysmal track record, and the fact that an astonishing 1 in 68 American children have autism diagnosis, one has to wonder why the revelations made by Dr. Thompson and Hooker hasn't become a major news story or prompted greater congressional scrutiny of the CDC. Well, even our own senatorial representation here in the state, look where their money comes from. You know, 2 years ago when Brother Hatch was running for re-election, the top 10 the Tribune published it. Top 10 contributors do not do business in the state of Utah. So who's he working for? Which is why I don't trust anybody. Someone tells me they want to run to office, I want to put them on a lie detector immediately. I think that's that. Did the point of this come across? Because sometimes I kind of fall all over myself. Oh, it's a big one. It's up there at the top. Yeah. I'll tell you what, if you will email me, jack@jackstockwell.com, I'll send you that link. But this is where investigators and whistleblowers are saying that 2004 publication in Pediatrics was crap. They purposely withheld certain kinds of information. So when you see something is 50% better or 75% better, usually there was a population of two people. One of them got better. Oh, it's a 50% miracle drug. Yes?
So going forward, I mean, not vaccinating is a no-brainer. But with the pressure to vaccinate, what do you recommend that people do?
Well, you can go to school. You don't have to, you know. You just go to the county health department, sign a waiver, and you can go to school. They can't keep you. They'll lie to your face and tell you you can't go to school if you're not vaccinated. And then they give you the threat of all threats, which is very intimidating. If we get whooping cough in this school, your child will have to leave. I don't think they do.
I think the concerns also go beyond that because here's the thing. A lot of people I've run into who've been against my choice, and hopefully people will respect my choice, but it's not going to become that, because you become the center of attention when the rest of the community is looking at you like you're a witch, you know?
Well, you are.
And so,
you're here. There's a bunch of witches here tonight.
So what I'm is those who think, I'm just saying that those who think that people are going to respect your choices and that there's not going to be consequences if you don't prepare from the backlash of your community and band together as like minds like we are, in some form, you know, you're going to be unprepared.
Well, I suppose. I find the older I get, the less I care what other people think.
I'm just saying that I don't care what other people think of me, because I'm done trying to convince people who won't be convinced. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I'm just trying to get the point across that it has to be a little bit more than I don't care what people think, because you got to prepare yourself.
Well, what are you doing to prepare yourself for the backlash?
I'm trying to network among like-minds here.
Well, that's good, and that's a good place to start. I'm offering an incredible discount, cheaper than anything you'll find on the internet, for 636 right there. There's a coupons for that. You call the office and you give them that code. And if there's not enough, you just call the office and said, Jack said you can get it anyway. Yes, ma'am, I may not have answered your question. I'm sorry. Well, yeah. The vaccine companies pay and buy Congress, and your concerns are the least of their concerns. And so, and they will try to legislate this as much as they possibly can. So you strengthen your body's immune system, which is what myself and my family are doing. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, and they'll tell you, like this article said, there's no thimerosal. The only way you can get a vaccine in Utah without thimerosal, they have to send to California to get it. I just found that out a couple of months ago. Of course, there's mercury in it. And then the vaccine makers just laugh at us. Safer? Sure, we can get rid of the mercury. Up the formaldehyde. Because they have to shock the system to get the immune system to recognize something dead. Yes, ma'am?
Last time you were here, you spoke about some things that you can do if you have to get vaccinated.
Yeah, chlorophyll.
Chlorophyll?
Oil-based chlorophyll, one of the most powerful blood cleansers there is.
And you talked about getting one vaccine at a time.
Yeah, if you're going to do it, make sure they do one at a time. And make sure you don't get an MMR till they're at least 4 years old. Most chlorophylls are water-based. You can tell the difference. You spill a little water-based chlorophyll, you clean it up. You spill oil-based water or chlorophyll, you're going to buy something new. And you get it on your body, it looks like gangrene. Well, the only oil-based chlorophyll I know of is Standard Process. The only one I know. Yeah, you're gonna be doing 636, or you're gonna at least be doing something to build your own immune response, because you're still gonna get a little bit of reaction from your immune system that follows nature's design, even though the humoral will try to take over everything. So you have a very strong immune system. You have a healthy gut. Oh, that's another thing. Yeah, my wife and I are leaving Monday to go back east to present two case studies of gut-associated health to Dr. McBride. Heard of Dr. Natasha McBride? There's a lot of people out there teaching GAPS, and they're doing wonderful, wonderful work, just restoring health left and right of terminally sick people. There's only five people in the state that have been personally trained by Dr. McBride herself. My wife and I are two of them. And we're leaving Monday to go back east to meet with her to present case studies before her in an audience of certified GAPS practitioner people. And she and Dr. McBride just recently released some information on some studies that were done on sheep being fed mercury. And when they had mercury-laced food. And when these sheep had been fed what sheep eat, grass, in a pasture with no pesticides or herbicides or anything, compared to a group of sheep that were fed processed carbs that make up the majority of the American diet, when they were both fed the same mercury-laced foods, 98% of the mercury came out in the spore of the sheep. Of the sheep that had the sick gut, 2% came out. That's how vitally, vitally important the health of the gut is. I take care of spines all day long. My wife is taking care of guts all day long. That's her job in the clinic, is to rebuild the health of the gut because of the strong connection between the brain tissue that exists in the gut and in the brain. Just NPR the other day, I was listening to an interview of some Parkinson's researchers, and they said, you know what we found? We found nerve endings in the gut that go directly to the brain in an area where Parkinson's develops. I about ran off the road, actually, when I, what? Somebody opened up a book from the 1950s and got on NPR and talked about it? Yeah, it's striking. A few questions and then I'll shut up. Red hair. No, it's food.
And then,
okay.
Sure. No. Is there a way to reverse the T-cell, like what the vaccine has done to us?
We don't know. The problem is when you give repeated vaccinations to anybody, that gets so flip-flopped that autoantibodies are created. An antibody is created by the B cells when you go through the normal process. Autoantibodies are antibodies that are attacking you. DeBakey research in Houston, the DeBakey people that invented the heart bypass operation, recently put out a report that said absolutely all heart disease is autoantibody induced. All heart disease is your immune system attacking your heart. TMIs, no, that's too much information. TBI. No, not TIAs, traumatic brain injury, TBIs. TMI, TBI. Traumatic brain injury. Two incidences of concussion, and the brain is swarming with autoantibodies against the brain. Is there a relationship between that and Alzheimer's? No research. We don't know. There was another hand back here. Yes, sir. Yeah, an acidic stomach will kill H. pylori. Helicobacter pylori, it's what causes ulcers. Dr. Royal Lee, one of my heroes, one of the reasons he developed Zypan, which is the digestive enzyme, back in 1931 or 32, was to make sure that the stomach was sufficiently acidified to destroy any bacterial population that gets in the stomach and grows there. And he postulated in late 1940s, early 1950s, ulcers are caused by a bug. Laughed out of the marketplace, laughed out of the country. Who got the Nobel Prize for Medicine 4 years ago in Australia? The guy that proved H. pylori causes ulcers. The Nobel Prize for Medicine. So yes, to answer your question, will vinegar do it? Yes. Well, to tolerance, to body tolerance. You don't have acid indigestion because you have too much acid. You have acid indigestion because you don't have enough acid.
Get vinegar with the mother in it.
Yeah, you want vinegar with the mother. You know, Bragg's, and Bragg's is a good brand. If you don't have enough, I didn't come here to talk about this, and I'm afraid I'm keeping you. If you don't have enough acid in your stomach, the pyloric valve will not open up. And the stuff sits there, and it rots, and it ferments, and it creates unnatural acids, and it creates gas, and that's where all the acid indigestion comes from. You start taking strong hydrochloric acid or good doses of apple cider vinegar with your meal or some other kind of acid-forming material. Usually, acid reflux is gone in 48 to 72 hours. Back in the back and then you. The red, yeah. Yes, I do. Prolamine iodine.
Prolamine
iodine, again made by Standard Process, because it breaks down perfectly to 48% iodine and 52% potassium iodide, which is the level of iodine in the cells.
And how much?
I take 6 a day. 4 a day will give you 12 milligrams. Japanese women, coastal Japanese women, who are eating their diet from the ocean, average 12 milligrams of iodine a day in their diet, and they have the lowest rate of breast cancer of the Western nations. Japanese coastal men who get their diet from the ocean, who average 12 milligrams of iodine a day, have the lowest rate of prostatic cancer in the Western nations. So I take 4 of them a day, gives me 12. Yes, sir? Oh, I forgot you. Yeah. Well, thank you. Yes. For what? You had a question?
Oh, what do you take for your gut?
I take Zypan. Yeah. If I eat fruit, I don't take any kind of a digestive enzyme. If I try not to have a processed carbohydrate with proteins, because that's the worst mix. You're going to have an upset stomach with that. But if I have anything that's got proteins in it, I'll take 2 or 3 Zypans with me, and you don't even know it's there. And if I didn't, I'd have a bloated feeling. But that's me. Yes, ma'am?
On the 636, you say before you go in to have surgery or whatever in the hospital, if you're already on that, is it necessary to get more?
No, if you've been on it for a while, you're probably saturated. Back in the back, yes, sir. Yes. Oh. Right. You alkaline people, just cover your ears for a minute. To tell me that the body should be alkaline is like telling me my body should face the north. My mouth varies between. My saliva is usually alkaline because of the amylase, but it can be acidic, but it can be alkaline. My stomach is as hot as battery acid, which is calmed down by the small intestine, which is very alkaline. Then when the contents get to the colon is acidic. And it has to be acidic because it's the barrier to outside bacterial agents, just like the skin, made of the same material as the skin. Parts of me are alkaline, parts of me are acidic. My blood is slightly alkaline, and there's a very, very small margin of that alkalinity for my blood. Goes a little high, I go into a coma. Goes a little low, I go into a coma. What's one of the first things they check on you if you go into the emergency room in a coma or unconscious? They do a blood gas immediately because they want to know which side of that margin you are, because you will die if you don't stay in that envelope, because all enzyme activity will cease if you get a little too alkaline or a little too acidic. If anything we could eat or drink would change that envelope in the blood, we would all be dead. I think that's a sales marketing program. Parts of me is acidic, parts of me is alkaline. Now, there is alkalosis and there is acidosis that usually shows up with diabetic problems. But for the average person, I think that's nonsense. Even the alkaline water business is failing. Yeah.
What does a bottle of soda pop do for you?
I'll give you two examples. Number one, the average 12-ounce can of soda right now has more sugar in it than your great-grandparents ate in a week. And high fructose even worse, because that's not a food. The second thing, a study was done a good 10, 15 years ago where they took a population 500 people, split them into two groups, 250 here, 250 here, and there was a few in the control, but basically 250 on each side, and they were given a diet of 3,500 calories a day. And it was a mixture between breakfast, lunch, dinner, some snacks, and something before bed, 3,500 calories. And so they stayed on this diet without failing for 2 weeks. Then at the beginning of the third week, one group was given 500 calories in addition to that of jelly beans. The other group was given 500 calories of soft drinks. By the end of the next 2 weeks, those that had the jelly bean group had incorporated that into the 3,500 calories, and they couldn't eat any more than 3,500 calories. Although 500 of it was jelly beans, they got 500 calories of the regular diet pushed aside because they just couldn't eat anymore. The group that had the 500 calories of soft drinks jumped up to 4,000 calories and stayed there for the two-week period. It didn't affect the 3,500 calories. Now, I'm not proposing you eat jelly beans. It's just the effect of all of that sugar in the system. 1906, the creation of Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Wiley was the first director of the FDA. The first thing he did, his first action as the director of the FDA, he stopped Coca-Cola production in this country, and he stopped the interstate transport of milled flour, of milled wheat. He said, those two things are killing more people in this country than everything else combined. Coca-Cola, and it was soft drinks in general, Coca-Cola and white flour. To this day, there's a federal law that forbids the interstate transportation of Coca-Cola. But any town of over 2,500 people has a Coca-Cola distributor in town. So they don't have to go over state lines. The milling industry, General Mills, Cargill, all the rest of them, came after him with a fury and had him thrown out of office, had Congress immediately remove him from office. So, to answer your question about, that was a long answer. Yes, sir.
Can you talk just for a second about how important cell oxidation is versus the myth about antioxidants?
The best antioxidant I have ever come across is duct tape. I measure the effectiveness of a nutrient in the body as to how long you can live without it. How long can you live without vitamin C? There's some evidence that says as long as you have vitamin C in the body, you won't die. And at the moment of death, especially in somebody elderly, a blood sample will be taken. It has been taken. No vitamin C present in the blood. How long can you go without food? It depends. How long can you go without water? 3 or 4 days? How long can you go without oxygen? You know, you close down the carotids, within 20 to 30 seconds, you're going to faint. You know that thing these crazy teens are doing where they put their arm around their buddies and choke off the carotids? Then they pass out, and then you wait for them to come back again, and they have a flatliner trip, and they go meet great-grandpa and stuff like that. 20 minutes or 20 seconds of stopping, you will go unconscious. 5 minutes later, neurons start dying in the brain. Now, to answer your question, yeah, antioxidants is a complete, total fraud. Cellular respiration requires oxygen. The whole body is based on an oxidative process. And you have certain enzymes the body makes to slow down free radical formation. But free radicals are what the T lymphocytes use to kill the invader by injecting them with oxidative compounds that cause the cell to explode. That's another big marketing trick. Yes, ma'am.
Two things. One of the best definitions for medicine I heard was that there are poisons with desirable side effects. But how can I find you on the radio?
I was waiting for somebody to ask that question. Because I see two or three listeners here, and I thought, gosh, is that all? AM 6:30, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m. AM 6:30. Or if you're too far away or the station hasn't powered up yet,
You can go to k-talk.com and click on Listen Now. You can hear it over your computer. Or K-talk, T-A-L-K. K-talk.com. Yes, sir?
Isn't it true that Ebola immediately wipes out all vitamin C from your body?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence for that. And what Ebola does is immediately attacks the T cells. Most retroviruses, that's what they do. AIDS is a retrovirus. And a retrovirus gets inside a cell and then just turns that cell into a factory for that virus. All it is, there's only 6 proteins in the Ebola virus, just 6 proteins. But those proteins have been created in such a way, and I'm not saying who created them because I don't know, but those proteins are created in such a way that their RNA, ribonucleic acid, the messenger part of your DNA system, and that RNA gets inside the cell. And inside the cell, you've got, you know, a cell's like a big water balloon. And in the middle of it is the nucleus. And in the nucleus is all the nucleic acids, the DNA. And the DNA creates RNA. And then RNA goes through the cell wall of the nucleus and gets inside the cell, telling the cell what to do. We're a lung cell. We're going to act like a lung cell. We're a kidney cell. We're going to act like a kidney cell. What Ebola does, or AIDS, or another retrovirus gets inside the cell wall, and these things are so small, they're not even bigger than about 80 nanometers. By comparison, 80 nanometers. If an Ebola virus was the size of a piece of spaghetti, a hair on your head would be as big as a redwood in California. That's the size relationship. So the RNA portion of the Ebola virus gets inside the cell and says, we're not a liver cell anymore. We are an AIDS virus manufacturing plant. And that's why it takes a while when you're exposed to it for that to get to a point where cells just start ripping open and the hemorrhagic response. And all of that stuff is your body's response to the invader. It's not the invader that does that. The invader is just looking for a home. There was another hand. Yes, ma'am? Well, who's saying that?
Oh, lots of people tell you that.
Well, I know lots of people. Yeah. Lots of people don't know crap. I mean, lots. Are they showing up with stacks of research?
Yeah.
No, of course not. And they'll say that they do, like my son was saying there. Oh, yeah, we got all these. Well, show me. What do I say to people like that? I say, bullshit.
In the mic, please.
Bullshit. Show me. Show me. I will be your number one missionary. Convert me. Show me the studies. Show me the studies. Well, there aren't any. That's right. They've read printed material like that ridiculous rag you were holding up there a minute ago. BYU Today?
Yes.
See, that's why Taysom got hurt, because BYU publishes stuff like that. I shouldn't have said that, because I was really rooting for the Y. I really was. Aspartame. Well, artificial. You know how they discover those things? They're discovered in inorganic laboratories that are trying to find some solvent to break down some particular material they're working on. And every now and then they'll come up with some new organic compound, and they'll go, man, that smells like sugar. That smells like tangerine. Boy, it tastes like a tangerine. Lifesavers, tangerine lifesavers. Now we got something else we can, tangerine jelly beans. All you got to do is put that organic chemical in there. And they do the studies, and they find out it wrecks the liver. It triggers certain aspects of the deeper parts of your brain where pleasure centers are located, heroin receptor sites, these are morphine receptor sites, things like that, that stimulate hunger, stimulate thirst. But they accidentally discovered it because it tasted sweet. They didn't go looking for an artificial sweetener. They just found this. Now, other companies will take the aspartame and try to break it down and chemically try to create some kind of a sweetener. Sodium cyclamate was the first one. which is the pink flavored ones. And then they came out with sucralose, where they took sugar and stuck a CH compound on the end of the sugar so the body wouldn't recognize it, so it would go through the system, which was the sales marketing program for that, that it tastes sweet but their body won't recognize it, which is nonsense because they find it building up in the liver. Your liver throws itself on a grenade every day for you. Everything you eat and drink, almost everything you drink, but everything you eat has to go through the digestive system into the portal vein, through the liver before it hits the major blood supply. And your liver literally throws itself on a grenade every single day because of what we eat. That's why liver tissue is so fast to regenerate. And it has to deal with aspartame. And it has to deal with anything that's not a food, let alone, you know, too much sugar or too much alcohol. The question was how to deal with Ebola, if you get it. You know, there's something squirrely going on here. Because there's people who should be getting it and they're not. And there's people who are getting it and they shouldn't be. The cameraman who was nowhere near anybody. The Duncan family, where are they? You know, they were there, they were privy to him, they were in his house, he dies, they're under observation for 21 days, but the WHO now says in 5% of the cases it's 42 days. There's actually a 6-week incubation period for some people. 2% of the crowd they investigated, they said we have no idea how these people got it because they weren't anywhere near anybody that was sick. So where's the Duncan family? They should have been paraded in front of television when they came out of their quarantine. You know, you could, you know, fuzz up the faces of the kids, but the rest of them, here they are. You know, here's the test. Here, coast to coast, front page papers. Here's their blood results. No Ebola. Nothing's present. They don't do any of that stuff. It's just like when they first landed on the moon. The easiest way to get rid of all controversy as to whether we went to the moon or not was to set up a laser rifle and shoot a laser signal to every major capital on the face of the planet. They could easily have done that, but they didn't. So now you have a whole group of people out there that think we never really went to the moon. It's the same thing here with this Ebola. There's stuff they're not telling you that they could be. And so, and as you pointed out, they're waiting until after the election to let out the rest of the information. I got to fly Monday back east. You know, I'm starting to get concerned about that myself. Then there are people in Kenya who are trying to get the Red Cross out of their country as fast as they possibly can, because the Red Cross is in there doing the work of God, healing these people of their sicknesses. But wherever they go, these viruses follow. And then they go to these families who are eating, literally eating dirt because they have nothing else. We'll put food on your table for a year if you'll let us inject your kids. We want to test these chemicals on your kids. Wherever that program has gone, these viruses show up, starting with Zaire and then Ebola Sudan and then Ebola Reston in Virginia. That mutated. It was a mutation of Ebola. Killed a monkey in 4 days. Humans got infected with it. It had no effect on the humans at all. Now you got a totally new strain of Ebola that's showing up in Sierra Leone. They just published a report that said our cases now are 9 times worse than they were a month ago. And we have places where they were considered Ebola-free, where the disease was completely cleaned out. People started coming back in, and now it's exploding. 9 times greater viral load than before. Viral load is when they take a sample of the blood, and they measure the amount of virus in a small portion of it. And they can do that under a certain kind of electron microscopy. Viral load means how much is present. They said the viral load right now far exceeds what it was 2 months ago. So the WHO's predictions of 10,000 new cases a week within 4 weeks from now may be accurate. And Sierra Leone, and then there's people now breaking quarantine, rushing, because there was, what was it, 1 million, 2 million people, something like that, in a Freetown that were completely surrounded, which is one of the reasons why I think our troops are going over there, to keep these people in the circle, as well as to secure the oil and the diamonds and the gold and everything else. But people are breaking those lines because they're starving, because nobody's giving them food, and they've eaten every last thing that's in the quarantine area. So the infected are now leaving the quarantine areas in numbers too big for the guards to contain them. Those stories are coming out over there. Now, what if it got loose over here? we're in a better health condition. We have better water conditions. We have better sanitation conditions. Hey, and listen, I'm sorry. If you don't get up and leave, I'm probably not going to shut up. So thanks, folks, for coming. But I'll, you know, I'm probably going to go on here as long as I have to. Yes, sir, in the back. Yeah, I know. Yes. Let me ask that question. Listen, if there's not enough of these left, you just call my office. 801-523-1890. Tell. I wasn't expecting this many people. South Jordan, I'm right there at 106 South in the freeway. Just call my office and say, listen, I didn't get a coupon. And I want what Dr. Stockwell said we can have, and you can have that same discount. It's a heck of a discount. 801-523-1890. You make copies of it, sure. Yes, sir.
Just this year, I read an article. You may have seen this because you're really up on everything. Of a medical doctor, it's a female medical doctor that was at this big convention speaking to medical professionals, and the pharmaceutical reps were there. And she said to this whole crowd that she engaged the pharmaceutical rep in a conversation asking them, why don't you pharmaceutical companies perform long-term studies on the efficacy of vaccinations? And she said he flat out told her, we are never going to do that. She said, why not? And he said, because if we were to do those studies long-term and find out that the vaccines are ineffective, it would cost our industry billions of dollars. We're not going to do that. Did you ever run across that?
Well, it sounds familiar, but I can't place it at the moment.
I saved it out. You can find it out.
What's the most important stuff you heard here tonight? Let me summarize it. Babies do not develop antibodies until they're 12 months old. They cannot develop an antibody. So a very close friend of mine who was sitting on a panel, this is two times removed, so it may be total nonsense, was sitting on a panel with some epidemiologists, some virologists, and some pediatricians having an open-air discussion like this on vaccines. And one of the epidemiologists made the comment, we know there's no humoral immunity in a child until they're at least a year old, some cases a year and a half. And some very intelligent person in the audience said, then why do the pediatricians tell us to get these babies vaccinated in the first year of life? Well, cha-ching is one of the answers, but the best answer was this. To train the parents to bring them in for vaccines. An epidemiologist said that, yeah. To train the parents. Yes, sir?
A few years ago, I saw an article talked about some conference on the indigenous population in third world countries, particularly Bill Gates.
Well, Bill Gates came out and admitted it. Yes. Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. But Bill Gates he's been quoted in several sources as having to say, the major problem in the world today is overpopulation, and we have various ways of taking care of that problem, and vaccines was one of them he mentioned. And you sometimes wonder if these people pay attention to what they're saying first. Yes. Yeah.
As I'm just curious how that affects the baby getting antibodies.
There's a very thin wall between mama's blood and baby's blood. Mama's blood doesn't go into baby. Baby's blood doesn't go into mama. Based on parents having different blood types, the baby may not have mama's blood type. But there's also associated with the type of blood an Rh factor of positive or negative.
Yeah, I think that. My first two are positive and negative.
Okay.
And so this one probably just happened to be positive too. But I was just curious how that affects my children as their immune system.
Oh, well, if that construct doesn't become a problem, it's not going to affect their immune system.
Okay.
But But you just don't want them. You want to be developing antibodies against them, and they don't want to be developing antibodies against what they picked up from you, and they can kill them.
Yeah. So in their early life, like, they don't have an antibody from me.
Right. Right. Just. Yeah, but they still have the innate immunity, and they still have some antibodies they got from you that are still good for a month or two. But by the time that month or two's gone by, their own T cell development has taken over, and their thymus is ruling their body until they get to be about 12 months, and then the humoral aspects start taking place. Yes, sir.
Are you willing to provide a copy of either your presentation or the video version?
Well, what is this? Yeah, it's being recorded here. Just talk to Tom. Tom will get you a copy of what they're recording here. One last question. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Well, I don't know if it can be reversed, but the attack, the autoimmune attack against the thyroid can be greatly reduced. That's another thing we take care of in our clinic. There's a lot of the autoimmune problems because we got some great stuff for that. I've never heard of Hashimoto's being reversed, but I've heard of it calming down, so the swings between hyper and hypothyroidism, those symptoms are abated. Yes.
If you have no thyroid gland, you still need to take iron.
Absolutely. Synthroid, levothyroxine, Armor. I recommend Armor. If you have no thyroid, you have got to take thyroxine.
If I take that, do I still need iodine?
Oh yeah, every cell in the body needs iodine. Now, thyrox, yes, you still need an iodine supplement. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir? Is what? Does what relate to fibromyalgia? Fibromyalgia is a combination of two things. Number one, the spinal misalignment. They used to call it neuralgia. And all the drugs for neuralgia ran out of patent, so they came up with a new drug, fibromyalgia, but there's also a prostaglandin imbalance between prostaglandin 1, 2, and 3 that contribute to certain kinds of inflammatory processes. That's another thing we address in the clinic. We usually have a lot of success. The hands keep going up. What am I supposed to do?
Oh, okay. Hey, can we give a round of applause for Jack Schauble, please? Okay. He's going to stay around for a few more minutes and answer more questions if you want to come up. We have a closing prayer right now from Al Jackson. Remember, next month, December 5th.